Thanks for joining us on this episode of The Sword and Trowel. This is one you're not going to want to miss, and you're going to want to spread this around to every pastor, every husband that you know, and others as well, but particularly those who are in those categories. This is a podcast where Graham and I talk to Joe Rigney about his recent book, Leadership and Emotional Sabotage, the subtitle of which is Resisting the Anxiety That Will Wreck Your Family, Destroy Your Church, and Ruin the World. This book is only a little over 100 pages long, and you ought to get a copy of it and read it, and you ought to buy extra copies and pass it around as well, especially in your church, because what Joe puts his finger on here and just shines the light on the way people actually try to steer us off of what God's called us to be and do is absolutely essential for us in this day and age. So tune in, share this podcast with others, and we think that you're going to be greatly appreciative and helped by it. Welcome to The Sword and Trowel. The Sword and Trowel is a podcast of Founders Ministries, and Founders exists for the recovery of the gospel and the reformation of local churches. I'm Tom Askell.
And I'm Graham Gundon.
And today we want to talk about something that is absolutely essential if you're going to see reformation in a local church or healthy leadership in a local church. And to aid us in this, we have asked Dr. Joe Rigney to join us all the way from Idaho. So Dr. Rigney, thanks for joining us on The Sword and Trowel.
Hey, glad to be here, boys.
Yeah, so Joe's written this book called Leadership and Emotional Sabotage, Resisting the Anxiety That Will Wreck Your Family, Destroy Your Church, and Ruin the World. Sounds like it might be a pretty important subject with those kinds of warnings embedded in the title. So before we get into how you wrote the book, why you wrote the book, and talking about the book, tell us a little bit about yourself and what you're doing out in Idaho.
Right. So currently I am a fellow of theology at New St. Andrews. So I teach our freshman kind of theology colloquium. So it's a class called Lordship. It's sort of a mashup of biblical theology, systematic theology, and practical theology over the course of a year. So that's kind of my main gig. I've got about 50 students in different sections. Mm-hmm. On top of that, I work at the church here at Christ Church, and do some stuff for new member care, as well as some pastoral duties there. And then I've taught a couple electives as well. And then other than that, I'm just kind of getting settled here in our first year in Moscow.
Okay, very good. And before that, you were out in Minneapolis, right?
Correct.
Yeah, so you were involved in Bethlehem, and you taught there and were president there for 2 or 3 years?
Yeah, so we were in Minneapolis for 18 years. About 15 of that was a professor, and 2 or 3 was two was as president.
Okay, very good. But most importantly, in terms of your academic career, is that your alma mater is the number one team in the nation in baseball. Is that correct?
I believe that is in fact correct.
That's amazing.
Go Aggs. Gig them.
Yeah, so it's Texas A&M University.
It's amazing they had any money left to fund a baseball team.
No, that's right. After Jimbo left, it was like, baseball. Sorry, guys.
Well, you know, one of my career aspirations is to be a fired coach from Texas A&M.
That's right. Aim high.
Yeah, so, well, Joe, tell us about the book. I mean, you tell a little bit about the genesis of writing the book, this Leadership and Emotional Sabotage, in the early part of this book, but tell us how it came together for you to finally say, man, I just need to put this into print.
Yeah, actually, it was Canon. When I came out here, Canon was the one real impetus to say, hey, we know you've thought a lot about this. We'd like to get something out on it. And some of that was, you know, over the past, I don't know, 10 to 15 years, about 10 or 15 years ago, I had read Edwin Friedman's Failure of Nerve. Mm. It was a book that Doug and I actually had a mutual appreciation for. I don't remember if one of us recommended it to the other. It could have gone that way, but we sort of had a shared appreciation for Friedman. And I had been teaching it at Bethlehem for a number of years in like a leadership course. And in that course was always kind of trying to translate Friedman's book, mm-hmm. because Friedman was an evolutionist. He's a Jewish rabbi, which means his mind kind of ran in biblical ruts. So you could tell there was just sort of some biblical habits of thought that were there, but it was also shot through with sort of evolutionary gobbledygook and some weird theology sometimes, and a really technical psychological vocabulary. And so I found it really helpful as a diagnostic and in some of its recommendations and prescriptions, but was always having to do this translation thing for my students. Mm. So I'd been doing that for a number of years. The infamous Man Rampant episode with Doug on the sin of empathy sort of emerged. Part of that came out of our shared appreciation for Friedman. And so he kind of is one that inspired that pathway for me. But I'd never, so that was the sin of empathy was a diagnosis of one aspect of Friedman's analysis. You know, it was one aspect of that. But I'd never done anything on the positive side. Like, what should we do? What should we be in response to this? And so this was just a great opportunity to pull it together. So Friedman's a major influence, clearly, but Shakespeare's in there. I know people have kind of gone, whoa, this is a weird first chapter. You talk a lot about Shakespeare and the Trojan War and one of his plays. But both of those, as I'm a professor of theology and literature, so that's where my mind goes.
Yeah.
But really the goal was use those as a way of understanding the modern situation, the contemporary anxiety, angst, agitation, turmoil, confusion that we sort of live in and that runs through the family, the church, the state, our businesses, schools. So use those as ways of sort of diagnosing it, translate it into biblical categories, and then offer the solution that God offers in the scriptures for this sort of problem.
You know, I remember, of course, you were out there with John Piper, but I remember when John came up with emotional blackmail, or at least that was the first time I'd ever heard that. And when I read your book, I'm thinking, well, this is kind of like the fleshing out of that and application of that beyond what Piper was talking about. And so, I mean, that must have resonated with you early on as well, I guess.
Absolutely. When the sin of empathy sort of stuff came out, one of the sources in there was John's comment about emotional blackmail, which is effectively when someone says, unless you do what I want, or unless you agree with me, affirm everything I say, you don't really love me.
So
it makes the person's sort of feelings the arbiter of whether love is actually happening. And once you're, and if you don't, then I might, it runs a spectrum, right? Mm. So if you don't do this, I'm going to throw a pity party. That's sort of at the mild end. And that's the one that we encounter most often in our families. Mm-hmm. C.S. Lewis in The Great Divorce has a couple of great scenes actually, where you have these, the damned spirits trying to basically emotionally blackmail their conversation partners, the saints that they're talking to, by pity, by wielding pity as a weapon to emotionally manipulate. So that's at the mild end of the spectrum, the more common end. But we've, in our society, we've sort of turned this up to 11, and you go to all the way to if you don't affirm that my gender transition, then I'll commit suicide. Mm-hmm. Right. So that's sort of the extreme end of the emotional blackmail, because you've got to affirm me or else. And so that sort of stuff does run through and is a major part of that anxiety, agitation that we're talking about that's running through our culture.
Thank you for joining us today for this conversation on the sword and the trowel. I wanted to make you aware and give you some more details on the regional conference that we are going to be having coming up here this July. That's July 26th and 27th, and it is the conference on family life in the negative world. Pastor Tom Askell, Dr. Joel Beakey, and myself will all be there speaking for that conference. It's going to be a wonderful time. You can go to founders.org/family life in order to register for that conference. It's just a shorter conference, a regional conference. It's just 2 days, but it's going to be a wonderful time of fellowship and thinking about what God has to say to us when it comes to how we are to live in families, be family members, and raise our families in an increasingly hostile world.
So you say early on in this book, you kind of lay the foundation from Shakespeare. I think it's Ulysses. About degree and the loss of degree. Can you explain that? I mean, because I had to read that two or three times and think, what's going on here? But it's kind of basically just social order or the way God's made the world, right?
Correct. Yeah. So degree is Ulysses' term, Shakespeare's term for basically cultural order. And which is a hard concept at one level because it feels a little bit abstract, but it really is something like, social orders are held together by something like gravity. It's the bonding agent that allows people who have different roles to sort of be doing different things, but be all on the same team, doing the same thing. So When you have unlikes, things that are unlike, so the various types of relationships. You got a husband, you got a wife, parents, children. Those are sort of obvious. But then you've got employer, employee, magistrate, citizen, teacher, student. You know, the all of these sort of relationships are all hierarchical at some level. And so there's this asymmetry in them, but somehow there's a bonding agent. And Shakespeare's term for this is degree. And when degree is strong, it's sort of like having a sun at the center of the solar system and all the planets orbit properly, right? Mm-hmm. They don't collide into one another. They're in their proper orbits and everything's working. When degree weakens, when degree, he uses a number of different metaphors. When degree is shaked, when it is concealed, when it comes undone, he uses a number of different metaphors to describe when degree collapses. What you have is basically planets that no longer have a center of gravity, and they're just running into each other, just careening around. And so a crisis of degree is when you have that sort of that degree is lost, and now the society is in unraveling. And the argument that I'm making, that Friedman was making, that Shakespeare, I think, was sort of, you know, alluding to in this story, is that that's where we live. And as a result, there's a sort of a number of features. And, well, the other thing I should say is degree is often embodied in those different leadership positions. So a king in a commonwealth, a father or husband in a home, a pastor in a church, in all, you know, the boss at work. All of these degree is sort of reflected in they're the center of gravity for their little institution, just as there's this larger idea of degree in the whole society. And I would argue in the cosmos, right? So like God at some level is the sun at the center of the solar system that makes everything work. So you lose him, you eventually are going to lose the little representatives of him in all of these different institutions. And it takes the form of a kind of abdication. Degree is a sort of abdication where the leaders refuse to take responsibility, refuse to do what they're called to do. And as a result, you get proliferation, you know, envies, rivalries, scapegoating, blame shifting, power struggles, all of these, this sort of chaos is the result of this collapse of degree. So that's sort of the basic diagnosis. I use it, I sort of, the structure in the book is kind of do a Shakespearean diagnosis, then come over to Friedman and say, he's talking about the same thing using the psychological language, and then sort of give the classic example, first example of the loss of degree in the Bible, which is Adam's failure in the garden. When he abdicates while his wife is being tempted, he then commits high-handed idolatry by choosing her, listens to the voice of his wife, chooses to follow her rather than God. And then when God shows up to judge him, immediately shifts the blame. Yeah, the woman that you gave me, she did it. And he puts it on her. And that pattern of abdication, idolatry, and blame shifting is sort of the heart of the failure of nerve, the loss of degree. And as a result, that's the that leads to the anxiety that ruins everything.
Yeah, you know, as I was reading through that first chapter, reflecting on it and beginning to get it. I mean, once you get it, you see it everywhere. Yeah. I mean, we're absolutely swimming in this soup of hyper-egalitarianism in which there just is no degree and there's complete chaos in our society. And that's writ large in our society and in our nation, but it's also, you know, you can bring it down further into particular institutions. You can bring it down to the church. You can bring it down to the family. And there's just a hyper-flattening out of all distinctions, and there's a hyper-egalitarianism where if that degree can be recovered, things can begin to fit into their proper order. And it's so interesting. I mean, even when in the Southern Baptist Convention, one of our leaders, one of our former presidents, J.D. Greer, came out with a statement a couple years ago in which part of his statement, he said, we are about the tearing down of all hierarchies. And that, I mean, he just unashamedly said, we need to tear down all hierarchies. And so a man who's supposed to be there to kind of be the embodiment of that gravity in the Southern Baptist Convention is the very one who is tearing down that gravity.
Yeah,
that's right. And it's interesting because I think when people hear that, I think this is a common thing, and there's layers to this problem. But when you hear, okay, it's, you know, the tearing down of hierarchies, the egalitarian, that could often takes the form in the modern world of sort of feministic impulses. A number of people hear that and heard me talk about this and thought you're blaming women for the problem. And I said, no, you have to understand, like that's symptomatic. The fundamental thing is the failure of men to be faithful, sober-minded leaders It's that abdication that comes first. So yes, mm-hmm. there is this sort of you listen to the voice of your wife in the negative sense. So there's a good way to do that. Sort of Nabal should have listened to Abigail. That mm-hmm. would have been a really good idea for him. Mm-hmm. It would have ended much better for him had he listened to the voice of his wife, his wise Proverbs 31 wife. But there's the negative sense of abdication where Adam says, you lead. I'm going to follow you. I'm going to let you call the shots here. You want to eat this? I'll eat this with you. And I choose you over God. That sort of thing is evil, and it's on Adam. God doesn't come mm-hmm. and say, Eve, you led this thing into sin. Mm. He comes and says, Adam, you failed. You failed to take responsibility that's been given to you. This is a fundamentally and first and foremost a masculine failure.
Yeah.
That's not to say that women aren't responsible and that they can't exacerbate and make things worse and all that sort of stuff. Like, men and women can sin here. And sometimes our social structures are set up in ways that are hostile to, this is actually part of the point of the book, is that if you recognize this and you start to say, oh, well, then I'm going to step up to the plate. I want to be a faithful leader. I'm going to take responsibility. What's going to happen? You might think, well, I'm obeying God. Everything's going to go well. And you would be wrong. So in this kind of context, if you do that, you should expect sabotage.
Yeah.
You should expect that the people in the system and the system itself, so to speak, will resist efforts to have this kind of sober-minded, well-defined, clear, courageous leadership. And therefore you'll be kneecapped at every turn and you'll wonder why I'm trying to do the right thing. What's going on? Well, you're being faithful and therefore you're getting shots.
Yeah, there's so much in that to unpack. But before we get to that whole idea of being steered by the system that is now in the hands of those that oppose God and his ways, I want to talk a little bit about this idea of, okay, order, cultural order in the mm-hmm. world. This is the way God made the world. I mean, gravity is not something you aspire to. It's not something you try to create. It is. And yes. I think a lot of times in our relationships, we're not recognizing this is just the way God made the world. Mm-hmm. He made men to be men, women to be women, husbands to be the head of their wives. This is not something you aspire to do. You're going to either do it well or you're going to do it poorly. But this is how God made the world. So that's degree from God, right? Would it be a proper way to say
that? That's right. So yeah, God is the center, and then he empowers and delegates authority in various spheres of society. And you make this point, and I think it's a really important one, and it's one that even sort of complementarian, patriarchal, whatever you want to call it, folks even don't quite get because of how pervasive egalitarianism is in our society. One of my common things, I'm giving this away, so if I ever come speak at somebody's church, they're going to be ready for it. But I'll go to a church that's solid on this issue. I did this just this weekend, and I said, does the Bible say that men should be the head of their homes? And inevitably, people start nodding, absolutely. And they know, yeah, we're holding the line. And I say, you're wrong. It does not say that. And they kind of start for a second. I say, the Bible says is the husband is the head of his home.
Yeah.
Right? The husband, whether he wants to be or not.
Right.
Right? It's not a question of should he be. It's not an obligation. It's not an imperative. It's not a command. Like you said, it's not an aspiration. It's a fact. It's an indicative statement in the Bible. Every time that headship language is used and is applied to men in the 1 Corinthians passage or in Ephesians 5, it's an indicative. The husband is the head of his wife. And then the call is, therefore, be a faithful head. Be a head like Christ as opposed to a head like Adam. So that's it's always faithfulness, unfaithfulness is the thing, not the question of is headship's up for grabs? Is it going to be her? Is it going to be him? And then God sort of puts his finger on the scales and says, it's the man. He should be the head. That's not how it works. This even comes out, just here's a little subtle thing. About like the way we talk about complementarity. For years, I heard complementarity summarized as sort of a doctrine of headship and submission. And this, I think, actually fed some of this. Actually, was tipping a hand, because what it was doing is it was taking the male indicative, headship, and combining it with the female imperative, submit. And so it was a confusion of categories. It should have been headship and bodyship, if you wanted to coin a term, right? That's the indicative side. And then it should have been love and submission. Those are the imperative side in Ephesians 5. And so we've often mixed those. And because of that, it's lent itself to think of headship as something we ought to aspire to, rise to. It's a command. It's up in the air. Who knows who's it going to be? Men should do it. Mm-hmm. But that's not the way that God made the world. Headship's a fact. The question is faithfulness.
It's a great point. It's mm-hmm. a really good point.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of The Sword and the Trowel today. If this episode has been helpful to you, or if any of the resources that Founders Ministries puts out is helpful, and there are many resources if you go to founders.org, we'd love for you to come alongside us to support us in our ministry and in our endeavors. The Lord's been kind to us and faithful to us and in allowing us to do so many things, from our publishing to our podcasts to our theological journals and conferences and many other things. But if the Lord is calling you to come alongside us and support us in this, we'd ask you to go to founders.org, and you can go to the Give tab there and support us financially. We thank the Lord for your gift.
So let's talk a little bit about, you have a section in there on steering, being steered. So a guy gets this, says, okay, I'm the head of my wife, I'm the head of my home, or I'm pastor of a church, and so I'm responsible to do these things. I see it clearly. I take my stand. I'm doing what God's called me to do. And you're saying, yeah, get ready to be sabotaged. So
that's right.
How does a person, both men and women, who embrace these realities that God has woven into the world and stepping into their responsibilities, how should they anticipate the efforts to sabotage their standing?
Yeah, there's a lot of different forms that sabotage stakes. I really focus on two in the book. The first is name calling. And this is really representing any kind of slander, false accusation, insults, name calling, all of that sort of stuff. You really have to recognize this as steering wheels. So we all want to be liked. We want to be approved of. The Bible tells us we should have a good reputation with outsiders. This is all what God expects. However, that good impulse can go wrong and become people pleasing, and then becomes a steering wheel. So all what the world figures out is Christians want to have a good testimony. They want to let their light shine. They want a good reputation. And so then they go, okay, well, if you don't do what we want, we're going to call you names. And nobody ever, you know, they don't name the strategy. They just start the name calling because they know, if I call you a racist, if I call you an abuser, if I call you a misogynist or an abuse enabler or a Christian nationalist or woke, you know, like this isn't, you know, the forms that we often think of maybe first as conservatives are the ways that the sort of the term the left uses for us, but it could work the other way just as easily, soft, compromising, et cetera, when you're just being faithful. And in those cases, when those accusations are false, they are steering wheels. They're trying to slap a label on your back, knowing that you will then jump through hoops in order to avoid the label. And so this is a fundamental tactic that the world uses to steer Christians. And oftentimes you have to, I've been trying to figure out, you know, with the new AI, you could kind of create memes. I had a friend who was trying to figure out how to create the AI art that would illustrate this. Mm-hmm. But the actual way it works is usually a series of steering wheels. So it's the world out there is calling us names, and you're a faithful conservative pastor and you go, well, what do we expect? The world's going to hate us. They told us that. So I'm not worried about that. But then a step in from that is sort of a compromised Christian, and they really care what the world thinks. They haven't learned that lesson yet. So they care that the world is calling Christians name. And so they start to maybe distance themselves from you because they don't want to be associated with the bad kind of Christian. And you don't care about that because you're like, well, that guy's compromised. He's woke. He's progressive, whatever. Who cares? Well, a step in from that is another person who cares what that guy thinks and wants to continue to maintain the relationship with that group. And so he cares. And you don't care because that guy's at a church across town. But then a step in from that is the elder on your team whose wife is friends with that guy's wife. And now he cares. And so you said something and it set off the world over there. And then the steering wheels all the way in, right? Everybody just steering until it gets to you. And usually when it gets to you, the form it will take is a reasonable friend, right? Who will say to you, hey, I know that it's not true. I know that this isn't exactly how it happened. I know that they're overreacting. And they will make all of the qualifications. And then they will say, but would you still maybe tone it down?
Yeah.
Would you still maybe back off? Would you still maybe apologize for what, you know, for something? All of those forms, and it's worldly influence that's being laundered through soft-hearted Christians, soft-hearted, reasonable Christians. And that's not to say that there aren't places where you need to hear the exhortation and apologize. Mm-hmm. But the question is always, what does God think about this? Mm-hmm. Not any of these people. These people are humans, and they could be wrong, or you could be wrong. And so you can't answer the question until you've gone to the Word and said, well, did God consider what I said a sin? Right. Did he consider it foolish? Was I unwise? And if he did, then it doesn't matter what they said. They could all be approving of it, and you should still apologize. Nobody could care, and you should go, well, I was still wrong. I'm going to seek God's forgiveness and seek forgiveness from my people. But if it's not, you must absolutely refuse to be steered.
Mm. That is so good, Joe. And it goes right to the heart of one of the things we have tried to emphasize and maintain, despite a lot of the very dynamics you just described, which is to appreciate what the Bible teaches regarding law and gospel. Mm-hmm. That, you know, what God commands, we got to do. What he forbids, we must never do. What he doesn't command, doesn't forbid. Then we are free under the general principles of his word and seeking his glory, all those things. But when somebody tries to position us to say, you must apologize, you must repent, and it's not sin, mm-hmm. I hope I will go to my grave before ever bowing to that type of intimidation. And yet, man, it is rampant.
Yeah.
And particularly where you live in an evangelical world where they don't appreciate law and gospel. Right. And so they just make up stuff as they go, you know, based upon the cultural winds.
You said, man, that is rampant. Was that a dog whistle or something?
Trying to play off a little bit of his English lit stuff there. So
yeah, I think that, what often happens, and Joe, you just said it, and Tommy, you said it, you know, somebody who you appreciate, someone who you respect will come to you and say, this person heard what you said, and they perceived it this way. Mm-hmm. And they felt this because of what they perceived that you said. And so I know you didn't mean that, what they perceived, but it still hurt them anyway. And so you must apologize to this person because of what they felt, because they misinterpreted, whatever statements you made. And that's right. Again, being steered by, and when you're not going back to the Word and saying, oh God, show me what is right, show me what is wrong. And rather you're going to people and thinking about, okay, if I hurt anyone, well, then I know that I'm in sin. Mm-hmm. The Word of God doesn't tell us that we're in sin when we hurt people.
That's right.
We're in sin when we harm people, but not when we hurt them.
Yeah, right. That's exactly right.
That's right. And this is, and I know that people hear this and they immediately think of all the ways that the principles we're talking about could be abused, mm-hmm. and they could. And so I'll say, yeah, absolutely. Some petty tyrant could use this as an excuse to sort of ignore all criticism and to dismiss it and never be humble and never hear what others have to say, which is why it's so important to get clear on this, say in an elder council, in a community, in a church community, in your home, and then nationally, right? So working its way out from there, because what you want is you need to be willing and expect the slander, and then you need to make sure the slander is false, mm-hmm. right? So there's a certain kind of mentality that says, if I'm being criticized, I must be right. And it's like, well, that's not true. That's mm-hmm. not it. If you're right, you will be criticized. But that doesn't mean that all criticism is, affirming you're righteous. You could actually be wrong too. Yeah. And so you need to have both the Word of God, and then you need to have sober-minded, steady men who will say, who will speak it to you. And they, what they'll do, if they're doing it rightly, they'll have Bible verses attached to things. If the accusation is coming and they say, yeah, there's something to this, here's the word, here's what you did, and here's the word that addresses it. And then based on that, you're repenting, not because of them, but because of the Lord.
Right.
You're mm-hmm. apologizing because of what God has said, and they're the means of drawing attention to the standard. So part of the counsel in the book is that we have to calibrate ourselves constantly by the Word of God. His standard has to be the standard. And mm-hmm. we don't want to flinch at things that the world says we must flinch, because then we're just, like you said, substituting one standard for another.
Tom and I wanted to invite you to come and join us down here in sunny Southwest Florida, January 23rd through the 25th for our National Founders Conference. This next theme for next year is going to be Revive Us, O Lord, a whole conference on revival. Dr. Tom Askell, Dr. Bodie Bauckham, Jeff Johnson, Dr. Joel Beakey will be some of the speakers that will be there with us. It's going to be a wonderful time, as the Founders National Conferences always are, of fellowship and growing in the Word. So go to founders.org, look at some of the information on the conference. We'd love to have you here. And if you'd like more information, you can see some of that at the end of this podcast.
You talk about the how cowardice is contagious as well as courage is mm-hmm. contagious. And whenever you're being attacked like this and you're being, somebody's trying to sabotage you, boy, there's a great responsibility, I think, for those who find themselves being shot at to not flinch and to not back off. Mm-hmm. Because very often the attempt is not to make you change, though there's some of that, but it's to warn others. You don't want to be treated like this guy's being treated. And it's like a whipping boy, you know, this is an example to everybody else. And whenever you find yourself being sabotaged like that, if you can stand firm and just mm-hmm. ignore it and not budge one inch, mm-hmm. then you're communicating courage and yep. you're actually helping others to say, oh, okay, we can stand too. But if you cave, you make it harder mm-hmm. for the next guy as well.
That's right. And what you said there is really important, that that when you're slandered, you might think I'm the target, and there is some of that. That's mm-hmm. often true. But frequently, there's multiple targets.
Right.
It's your friends that are actually the target. It's, we're going to slap enough labels on this guy or this group that that nobody else will want to be friends with them, that mm-hmm. everybody else will put some daylight between them and others. And this is what's going on. You know, the text I use to kind of illustrate a lot of this in the church context is from Galatians. And where Peter and Paul have their confrontation at Antioch, because you can just see those different layers I was just talking about. You've got the circumcision party out there that's, you know, upset about the Gentile inclusion. Mm-hmm. And then they, you know, because of that, they're persecuting the church in Jerusalem. That's James and the apostles. They send messengers. There's another step to Peter. And they have a message. We're not told what it is, but we can, I think, reasonably speculate that it was something like, hey, you eating with the Gentiles is causing problems for us. Could you maybe put some daylight between you and the Gentiles until this blows over? Because I don't think that Peter, as the one who received the vision of in Acts 10, would have been confused about the principle. In fact, Paul says, you know all of this, and yet you're not acting like it. Your conduct is not keeping in step with the gospel that you know. And so Peter's not confused on the principle. And so what's the reason? What would lead him to act in this hypocritical way? And the answer is fear. He's afraid of that circumcision party and what they're going to do to the church in Jerusalem and how that's going to reflect on him. And so because of that, what does he do? He distances himself from the Gentiles. Mm-hmm. And like you said, this is the contagious part. It says the Jews followed him, even Barnabas. And that even Barnabas is the most, you know, that even word there in the New Testament is so pregnant with meaning, because this is the son of encouragement. He got a new name mm-hmm. because he was willing to take risks for the gospel. And now out of fear, he's following Peter into hypocrisy. Mm-hmm. And so because cowardice is contagious. And then Paul sees it. He's sober-minded. He sees what's happening. And he says, I have to confront this. I have to name the elephant in the room. They're not going to like me, probably. It's going to be awkward. Everybody's going to, you know, there's a lot of popcorn memes, right, with people going, this is Peter and Paul showdown at Antioch. And everybody's going to feel the tension and the crack in the room. And Paul says, but I had to do it because integrity demanded it.
Yeah. You know, this there's a book came out in 1989 called After the Ball about how America will overcome its homosexual phobia and such. And jamming, I mean, it sounds exactly yes. like their strategy. You desensitize the issue of homosexuality, and then you jam people who yes. are a little bit skittish about homosexuals. You say, well, the skinheads are opposed to homosexuals too. Why, look at you, you're mm-hmm. being a skinhead. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what's going on here too, it seems.
Exactly right. It's the same thing that's happening with the whole Christ is King discourse, where you've got some crazy anti-Semites or something who've appropriated that. Yeah. And now everybody's like, should we say it? Should we say amen? Yeah. What if they think that we're associated with them?
Yeah.
One of the things, this isn't in the book, but I've thought about writing something on this, is when you look in the book of Acts, the number of times that there is confusion about the early church and about the apostles and about what they're doing is striking. Mm. Over and over again, they're confused with other groups. Mm. They're thought to be revolutionaries. There's the time in Acts 20 where when the Paul gets arrested, the tribune comes to him and says, Paul says, can I say something to you? And he speaks in Greek. Mm. And the tribune says, oh, you speak Greek? Aren't you that Egyptian who led 400 assassins into the wilderness to overthrow the government? And Paul's like, well, no, I'm just a Jew from Tarsus. But he doesn't spend all of his time trying to differentiate from the Egyptian assassins. He's like, can I have the microphone, please? I would like to say something to the people. Mm-hmm. I have a message. He stays on mission. He doesn't get derailed by trying to, he's happy to say, nope, not with those guys. But then he's back on mission. He doesn't hop to. The only time that Paul, this is funny, because part of my book is all about sober-mindedness, steadiness, mm-hmm. not reactive, not emotionally blowing up or panicking. There's two times in the book of Acts where you see Paul have strong emotion. One is when he's provoked by the idolatry in Athens. Mm-hmm. And the other is when at the island, I forget which island, they try to worship him mm-hmm. and yeah. Barnabas. And all of a sudden, he's like, no, whoa. He says, are you crazy? And so the only time that he really tries to shut it down hard and say, that's not who we are, and spend some time, is when they're about to be worshipped. So I would suggest, if some folks want to worship us, we should really put a stop to that in a hurry. But if they're simply confusing us for other groups that are pursuing ends that we don't care about and that are wicked or whatever, we should just say, not us, and move on. Yeah. Don't get derailed. Don't get sabotaged. Don't get steered.
Mm. You know, it's so good. And it ties into another thing you emphasize here about mission, understanding your mission, mm-hmm. what it is, what it's not, because yeah. it's so easy to be knocked off course because you've got other considerations. And I think that's where a lot of the problems arise in our homes and in our churches that make us more vulnerable to being sabotaged, to being steered, is we're not clear. Yeah. What has God called us to be? And what has he called us to do? And let's just stay the course there, regardless of what might come against us.
Well, you don't need to be steered off course. You don't need to be knocked off course when you're not even on a course because you don't know what your mission is.
That's right. It doesn't feel like you've lost anything.
And so that's the first failure of leadership. And I think a lot of, especially fathers and husbands, you know, head of households, don't understand that, like you said, it's not you ought to be a leader in your home. It's that you are a leader in your home. And so you have a mission for your body, for your family. And what is that mission? Many men don't understand that they have been given a mission and they have to, you know, hone that mission specifically for their family. And so their family, they have no course. Their family has no course. That degree is vacuumed out of their family. And so, yeah, of course they're going to be prone to be steered by, you know, the passions of their wife and their children and all those things. But honestly, that doesn't even matter because they're not on a course anyway.
Yeah.
Right. It's why it does start in the home. And, you know, this is a minor part of the book, but it's there about that the household is an institution. And it's a body that has a mission. Now, because we often think, our church has a mission. And it's like, that's absolutely true. So does the household. God gave the household a task. It's fruitfulness, multiply, the cultural mandate, like the first institute. That's a given to the human race. But the institution that God supplied in order to fulfill that mission is the household. That's where fruitful multiplication, filling, that's children, you know, and then dominion, take and subdue the earth, is the sort of a household. That's the first place it happens. So your household has a mission and you're the head of that home. And therefore you lead out in that mission. You structure and order your household for that mission. And this is hard. This is hard. This is not something I was not raised to think that way. I was raised by Christian parents, but this was not the way I think that my folks thought about things, just kind of, you know, going along. And so, I suspect that in Christendom conditions, where the culture itself is sort of at least more or less hat tips, mm-hmm. God standards, there is a way in which you can kind of be carried along by it because right. the cultural current yeah. is at least in the right direction. And I grew up in the South in Texas, in a kind of a suburban sort of setting. And so I think that was a blessing to me. It compensated mm-hmm. for maybe the absence of a family identity in that way. In this world, the negative world, you've got to be real clear on what the household is for and how the members are meant to fit together in order to accomplish it, because otherwise the world is going in an entirely different direction. And this is the responsibility fundamentally of the head. Mm-hmm. He needs to know what the mission of the household is and what his mission is within it. What my job is to structure this baby for what God wants it to do. I need to empower the members of my household to fulfill their calling. I need to guard and protect it so that, you know, and so all of those sort of things are basic and often unrecognized. And if we fail to do it in our homes, it's a good bet that we'll fail to do it in our church and in our business and in our schools and on and on and on, because the household is where we learn fundamentally how to do it.
Mm-hmm. Amen. Well, that's a good message. Your book is full of wonderful insights that are always applicable, but especially in the day in which we're living now, where we've lost that current that used to run generally according to the way that our nation was founded and the biblical principles that undergird that. And now it is completely negative coming against us. If you don't see that, then you're just going to drift along with it. And if you don't understand what it takes to lead the way God's called you to lead or to support leaders the way God has called you to support leaders, you're going to be sabotaged. Mm-hmm. So we got this book when I got an advanced copy of it and I read it, and we ordered copies for all of our elders, all of our deacons. We're reordering copies for all the folks in the church. We want everyone to read it. So I speak as a fellow pastor, and I would say, you know, as those of us who are still involved in the SBC, this is desperately needed. Absolutely. In the Southern Baptist Convention.
Absolutely.
I've said for years we've had a failure of leadership all across the board in the Southern Baptist Convention. This book explains how that failure has mm-hmm. occurred, and I believe by good men, you know, intended well, but they got sabotaged and they didn't realize it. So pastors, get this book, get it to key leaders in your church and work through it with them. Fathers, husbands, get this book, work through it, and make sure that you understand what the Bible calls you to be, what God says that you are, and the responsibilities that go with what God has created you to be and called you to do. So, Joe, thank you so much, man.
Yeah, on that, let me just give you one resource, too, that for this particular moment, which you mentioned about the SBC there, because I do think this is providential. I didn't write that, you know, I wrote this last year, and wasn't necessarily thinking about any particular thing. But then here the timing's come out as it has. Michael Carlino has written an article. It's a half book review, half book application. I think it's at Christ Overall, Michael Carlino. Yes. And it basically is he takes my book, he understands exactly what I'm talking about, and he does a masterful job of taking the principles and then connecting all the dots to what's gone on in the SBC over the last, say, 5+ years, especially.
Yeah.
Whether it's the abuse task force, whether it's the law amendment coming up in June, all of these sort of things that he sees the book. I think Michael was seeing it already, but the book gave vocabulary and he said, this is the stuff, this mm-hmm. is the principles, and here's how it's playing out. And so if you're in the SBC, I'd encourage you to go find that article, pick up the book, and then come to June ready to resist the sabotage.
That's a great mm-hmm. idea. And we will link to that article by Michael at Christ Overall, because he does applies your book, what you've taught, to the SBC to show how the SBC is not drifting. It's being steered.
Mm-hmm,
it's being steered. And so it's a great article. Thank you so much for writing this, Joe. Thanks for joining us today. We're always glad to have you here, and look forward to another opportunity down the road. If we can do anything to serve you here at Founders, please don't hesitate to let us know.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
Thanks for joining us today on The Sword and Trowel. If this episode has been helpful to you, then share it and make it known to other folks. And if we can do anything for you here at Founders, please reach out to us.